Chapter 11. Scott Humphrey. A brief interlocution in which a much-discussed producer speaks for himself. What were your first impressions on working with the band?
They are, you know, very unique people. At first, it was a cool thing to be working with them because there was always drama. When I first met them, the drama was kind of fun. And I loved watching Tommy play his drums, just breaking cymbals in half and busting his drumsticks right and left. But then all of a sudden, I was sitting in the producer's chair and it was impossible to get anyone, except Mick, to show up on time. After a while, we instituted a system of fines, $100 for each hour someone was late. Then it was another struggle to separate everyone from their pagers and cell phones. Days were just wasted without any work getting done. Things got worse once we moved into Nikki's gated mansion. Every day, Nikki would have to duck out of recordings to deal with the gardener or the pool guy or the fish lady or the car detailer or the maids who came twice a day to do the breakfast and evening dishes and chores. There was no end to the number of people working to keep that house standing. One of the things I'd like to talk to you about is Mick's hat.
Mick's hat? What?
He said that you called a meeting with management to complain about his hat.
This definitely confirms some of the stuff I've heard out of Mick Mars's mouth, because that is ludicrous.
So you never had a problem with his hat?
That is just not possible. Mick Mars always wears a hat, except for when he's on stage sometimes. But who gives a shit whether he wears a hat or not?
Mick's not one to just make something up, though.
I'm sure if it happened, no one else remembers it but Mick. I think it's kind of weird. In fact, you know what? He used to always wear this Motley Crue racing hat, and I loved it. I said, "Hey, Mick, can you get me one of those?" And months later, he got me one. I'm looking in my closet now because I think I still have it. I was fixated on his hat because I wanted one, not because I didn't like it. Here it is. I found it. I'm blowing the dust off it now. It's got a skull and bones and racing flags on it. It's a black leather hat. I remember this distinctly now. He must have gotten it all wrong. The hat was all good. What was not good must have been something else.
Well, he did feel like you were invalidating him as a guitarist.
That really didn't have anything to do with me. Tommy and Nikki both liked the way that John Corabi played guitar, and they were always encouraging John to play. As the producer, you want to be very open and let everyone bring their parts to the table. But Mick just didn't want anyone playing the guitar. He'd scream out, "I'm the guitar player." It's like, okay, you are the guitar player, but two other guys in your band want to hear John Corabi play. Sometimes the sound of two different guitar players playing the same part is a nice sound, like with AC/DC. It's funny that he would remember me being the guy who didn't want his guitar parts because I wanted to make a Motley Crue record that sounded like the early stuff. What I really liked was pure Mick Mars raw guitar. In fact, I was always encouraging Mick, and he would bring me these cassettes called table scraps, which were bits and pieces of things he was working on at home. What really used to make this band work well was Mick writing guitar riffs and Nikki writing things over the top of them and Vince singing it all. That was the formula. Most of the riffs we were working on were based on John Corabi guitar parts, and those were these bluesy Zeppelin guitar riffs, so it was almost like the Motley Crue writing machine had shut down. Corabi probably hated me from the get-go because jamming was something he had brought to the band, and I wanted them to get back to writing songs again.
So you were the one who wanted to make a raw Motley record, and the rest of the guys wanted to sound more up-to-date?
Exactly. Nikki wanted to be Nine Inch Nails one day and U2's Zooropa the next day. Nikki and I were always going at it. We had argument after argument over lyric content. Nikki didn't like to have his lyrics scrutinized. There was this line in this song called Glitter that went, "Let's make a baby inside of you," and I was like, "There is no way. You can't put that line on this record." It was ridiculous, and he basically tried to say that it was the best thing he'd ever written.
What kinds of things did Nikki say about me?
I think he felt like you were getting into head games and playing him off against Tommy. He said he needed a stronger producer to tell him he was full of shit sometimes.
Really? I think that most people would remember me being the guy who kept saying, "Quit trying to be Trent Reznor. Just fucking sit down with a guitar and write songs." All I was trying to do was get a hit. I didn't care about anything but selling records. After all the time and grief and drama we all put in, the least we could have was a hit.
I think the band thought that in your mind, nothing was ever good enough.
That is the way I felt. The record sounds like a bit of a mishmash, and that it didn't sell is proof that it wasn't good enough.
Did Vince's return make things any easier?
No, the songs weren't written toward Vince's singing style or even his range. So even more so at that point, we needed fucking Mick to do what he did and unite the band. They were so good when they worked together as a band instead of as a bunch of fucking dysfunctional partners. With John, the problem was that his voice was always blown out. With Vince, there was an entirely different set of problems. We had what we used to call the Vince Neil window of opportunity. It was between beer 3 and beer 6. That was where he'd be warmed up after the hangover, but not so drunk that he couldn't even stand. And the window could close really fast. Sometimes we'd only have half an hour or 20 minutes with Vince. And if you asked him to sing more than a couple of times, he'd be like, fuck you, and he'd leave. My impression of Vince was to hold up my wrist and look at my watch. He didn't want to be in the recording studio. He'd rather be on the golf course.
So even when he was back, he didn't act like he was part of the band?
I think there was a jealousy because Nicky and Tommy were co-producing the record and he wanted to be a co-producer too. He could have co-produced, but we couldn't get him to the studio to sing, much less to produce. Vince is one of those guys who you can't push too hard. If he does show up and he happens to do something and it happens to be good, well, you get what you get.
Was Pamela Anderson around during the recording?
Well, we all went through some really good times with Pamela and some really shitty times with Pamela during the recording of that album. She used to do this thing every Friday where she'd come by the studio with a bottle of vodka. She'd say, okay, it's Friday, you guys are getting drunk. She insisted that Tommy get shit-faced every Friday. Then fast forward a few months, and she's on Jay Leno saying, my husband's an alcoholic. I was just thinking, what is she talking about?
So what was going on in your mind during this whole recording process? Were you thinking, get me out of this nightmare?
It was really hard because when it was convenient, I had two co-producers. When it wasn't, I was on my own doing all the work. In the end, I went out screaming. I'll never forget this because my mother was sitting beside me at Christmas time, and I was talking to Nicky on the phone. I was saying, if you don't come up with a better first single, your career is finished, and 6 months from now, you are going to blame it all on me. And he goes, no, I know exactly what I'm doing, and I'm doing the right thing, and this is the perfect first single. At that point, I was sure that the reunited Motley Crue wasn't going to blow up just because the material wasn't good. If they had the right record, they could have easily gone double or triple platinum.
So you decided to wash your hands of it all?
What else could I do? You get tired of constantly saying no, 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 and arguing with people all the time. When the first single stiffed, I got a call from Nicky who said, I think we released the wrong single. You fucking asshole, I screamed at him. It didn't matter anyway, because by the time the album came out, Motley Crue had become celebrities on a scale they probably never could have imagined in their worst nightmares. It was really strange to me because all of a sudden, their personal lives became more important than their music.